American preaching has a nervous breakdown. And what I mean by that is that the way that we preachers go about doing our business, suddenly we sense people aren't listening anymore, aren't listening as hard as they used to. And the reason for that is that something has changed in the culture. For example, young preachers today, especially young, not only young, are experimenting with using screens and visuals in worship. And it's not because they enjoy spending the week searching out film clips and things. It's because they think that we've moved into a visual period in our time. So I want to talk this morning about some of those fashion changes in preaching. Some of them still affect us today, and some of them have gone their way. Just as an example, the first example, whoops, been get back to the where it's supposed to be. I don't know how I did that. There we go. Okay, I doubt that anybody recognizes this gentleman. His name is Edward Thompson Taylor, and he was among the most popular preachers in America in the early 1800s. He preached in a mariner's chapel called Seaman's Bethel in Boston, and the literati came to hear him. Ralph Waldo Emerson was a huge fan. Walt Whitman, whenever he had a chance, would come and hear Edward Taylor. In fact, wrote an essay about him. When Charles Dickens came to America, he was not interested in hearing preaching except for one preacher, and he went to hear this man. What makes that really strange is this person is illiterate, or basically illiterate. Somebody had to read the scripture for him. He ran away to sea when he was 7 years old, never had formal education, but he had the anointing. He had the ability to coin a phrase in rich imagery. Also, he represents one of these nervous breakdowns in preaching. If you were to go into the large Boston churches in his day and look at the pulpits, where would they be? That's right. And the theological reason for that, of course, is the exalting the Word of God. But the accidental circumstance of that is exalting the preacher who thunders 10 feet above contradiction from these large pulpits. And when Herman Melville wrote Moby Dick, he included among the characters a preacher, Father Mapple. And he preaches a famous sermon, takes up a whole chapter in Moby Dick, and he preaches it from a pulpit that is shaped in the form of the prow of a ship. I mean, you can't have anything more imposing than that. But listen to what he says, because he's modeled on this man. Shipmates, notice the nautical imagery, that was what he used. God has laid but one hand upon you, but both of God's hands press upon me. I've read ye by what murky light may be mine the lesson that Jonah teaches to all sinners, and therefore to ye, but still more to me, for I'm a greater sinner than ye. Now, no preacher would say something like that in one of those exalted pulpits. I'm more sinful than you are. I'm more exalted. No, no. This man literally, figuratively, came down out of the pulpit and talked in everyday, ordinary language. Picturesque, humorous, but it was the ordinary speech. It's one of the tensions that is going to run through American preaching the whole time. The fancy sermon versus the plain sermon. The sermon preached from on high with great literary skill and oratorical mastery versus the plain-speaking, rough-hewn, everyday preacher. And this guy, he sounded rough-hewn and everyday. He was a marvelous image maker and storyteller and humorous wit. But he was the, I now would gladly come down from this masthead and sit on the hatches there where you sit and listen as you listen while someone of you reads to me that more awful lesson which Jonah teaches to me. Notice him coming down figuratively out of the pulpit. Well, let's go back in time a little bit. Oh, gosh. I should not be allowed to use these things. This is why I can't enter the digital age in preaching. Anybody recognize him? That is Quaker Oats, yeah. Now, that's Cotton Mather. Cotton Mather is a Puritan preacher. His sermons, generally an hour or two in length, and they were, like all Puritan sermons, kind of formulaic, and they're formulaic in this way. These guys were Calvinists, and in Holland, there was a Calvinist rhetorician by the name of Peter Ramus, and he came up with an idea about how to get at the meaning of texts, biblical texts, but all texts. The first thing you did, said Peter Ramus, is you went and got the major ideas that were there. Then you began to see the pattern intellectually in which these ideas sat. That is to say, the rationality of these ideas, the reasons why they were true. And then the last thing you did was to think about how useful they are, what you should do with your life if these ideas are true. That became a formula for Puritan preaching called doctrine, reason, use. Now, if you are accustomed to three-point sermons, this is one of the origins of that. Now, these Puritans would divide each of these three panels into subpoints, 22 subpoints for each one, so they went on and on and on. But the sermons were doctrine, what are the ideas in the biblical text, reason, why they're true, and use, what you're supposed to do about it if they are true. Now, the very first textbook in preaching ever written, as far as we know, Christian textbook, was St. Augustine's Book 4 in On Christian Doctrine. Books 1, 2, and 3 are about the Christian faith, and then in Book 4, how do you preach it? How do you teach it? And in Book 4, he asks an interesting question. What is the purpose of a sermon? And he says, the purpose of a sermon is to teach, to delight, and to persuade. Now, he stole that from Cicero, but it's okay. He baptized it when he brought it over. And what he meant by that was, the first job of a preacher is to teach the truth of the gospel. The second is to teach it delightfully so that it moves the heart. And the third aim of a preacher is to persuade. And he didn't mean what we ordinarily mean by persuade. What he meant was to open up the way of living that's inherent in the thing that you've preached. Now, he thought that all sermons ought to do all three of those things. What he wanted to hear at the door was, I learned something this morning. I was moved by what you said, and I intend to do something about it. Teach, delight, and persuade. But actually, in the history of preaching, we move through periods of teaching, delighting, and persuading. And right here with the Puritans, we're definitely in the teaching mode. And so the cognitive aspect of preaching is important. What's wrong with that? It's boring. You finally get tired of two-hour lessons from the pulpit. And so along comes yes, this is George Whitefield. Now, Whitefield was in the same period with the Puritans, but there was a reaction against the Puritans. We call it the First Great Awakening, where suddenly you have kind of revivals taking root. And Whitefield was a revival preacher. He was a Calvinist, but he fell in with the Methodists and was moved by the Methodist experiential emphasis. He came to America, and he was unbelievable as a preacher. He was a revival preacher, but they said he could move people to tears simply by saying the word Mesopotamia. It is thought that he preached 18,000 sermons in his life and 10 million people heard him. Now, this is in the 1700s. This is not television. 10 million people heard Whitfield preach. When he preached in Philadelphia, he stood on the steps of the courthouse in Philadelphia, and a crowd gathered, and Benjamin Franklin was there. And Franklin was less interested in the sermon and more interested in the marvelous instrument that was Whitfield's voice. And he said, "How many people can hear this man? He has a trumpet for a voice." So Franklin backed up from Whitfield's as far as he could and still hear him, and then calculated, based on a radius done from that point, how many people could have heard him. And the figure turned out to be 30,000. I mean, that's preaching in Wrigley Field without a microphone. 30,000 people could have heard Whitfield. He was very theatrical. So unlike the Puritans, he put his body into it and acting into it. He would act out biblical stories. He would pause in the middle of a sermon and say, "I think I hear them. I think I hear the angels in glory singing, oh, would you not want to join that choir?" I mean, and people were powerfully moved by this. The Harvard faculty, however, were sharply critical of Whitfield. This was back in the day when Harvard faculty cared about preachers. And the reason they didn't like Whitfield was he had doctrine and he had reason, but his use section was always the same: come to Christ. In other words, the only way to use the text was conversion in Whitfield's scheme of things. And so they said, this is inferior interpretation of the Bible. Didn't matter. People loved hearing Whitfield. Now, eventually the First Great Awakening waned and things fell back into a teaching mode. Now, notice that Whitfield's in the persuasion mode. That's what he emphasized. But it falls back into the teaching and things got pretty dull again. And along comes another reaction. Anybody recognize this guy? Scary, huh? Okay. This guy's name is Charles Grandison Finney. And what Finney did, well, he was a layman, basically, who became a preacher. And Finney sensed that a nervous breakdown was happening in preaching. The preachers of Finney's day, like actors, lawyers, public orators, anybody who made a living speaking, they tended to be formulaic and overly dramatic. "I wish to speak to you tonight about three things from Paul's letter to the Corinthians." And they had these huge gestures. Everybody knew they didn't talk that way at home. You don't go into the breakfast, "Darling, I would like an English muffin." You know, you just don't. That's not the way you talk. But that's the way you talk when you're talking in public. Something happened in the culture that said, "I don't trust somebody who talks differently in public than the way that they talk in ordinary life." Notice the tension now between fancy and plain. I don't trust fancy. I want plain. So Finney began to experiment with what are called the new measures in preaching. Instead of the big gesture, he would do the everyday gesture, just like you would do if you were having a conversation. He would, instead of the polished elocution of the great teacher preacher, he would practice mistakes. So the thing that I want to tell you tonight involves, like he couldn't find the word, and then all of a sudden, "Grace." I got it. He got rid of the pulpit so that he could have eye contact with everybody. He then began to design sanctuaries that had sight lines in the sort of semi-round. Everything was designed to create an emotional connection with a preacher who is preaching in ordinary, trustworthy ways. And a new word entered the vocabulary of American preaching: sincerity. We think that Jesus was sincere. Actually, that word didn't enter into it. Would assume that people were telling the truth, but I'm speaking from the heart, that kind of sincerity. And Finney was fantastically successful with this. He was another revival preacher, the second Great Awakening. And people went to hear him because they were moved by what he said. Some people would say, I didn't agree with a word of that, but it was so sincere. And it changed the way people preached. Young preachers began to imitate Charles Finney. And when you imitate sincerity, it begins to break down a little bit. But but they imitated this guy. And if you have ever heard, or if you have ever said yourself, you know, I love it when he doesn't have a note and he just speaks from the heart. He brought it into the vocabulary of American preaching. And he changed the way other people spoke. Bum, bum, bum. The most famous speech probably that this man ever gave was the Gettysburg Address. He was not the featured speaker that day. Edward Everett, the great orator, was the featured speaker for that day. Listen to the first paragraph of Edward Everett's speech for that day. He's the old school. Standing beneath this serene sky, overlooking these broad fields, now reposing from the labors of the waning year, the almighty Alleghenies dimly towering before us, the graves of our brethren beneath our feet, it is with hesitation that I raise my poor voice to break the eloquent silence of God and nature, but the duty to which you have called me must be performed. Grant me, I pray you, your indulgence and your sympathy. 2 hours later, he finished. And then,
4 score and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth the prophet's covenant, a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Now,
didn't
mean to interrupt the president.
Whether that nation or any nation so conceived, so dedicated, can long endure.
Now that's clearly 19th century speech, but you notice the difference? It's plain speech. And who remembers Everett today? And school children can recite this. Charles Finney had an associate pastor. He was a Presbyterian minister. And when Finney would go on the road for revivals, his associate pastor would maintain the church that Finney was connected to. And this pastor was a new style, like Finney, and he got tried by the presbytery for heresy and almost removed from the ministry. And his son watched this travesty happen, and as a result of it, his son lost his faith and became the most famous atheist in America. Anybody know his name? Robert G. Ingersoll. Robert G. Ingersoll. He spent his whole life at Chautauquas and other places like that, giving speeches about atheism, debunking the Bible. He was very dramatic. He would get his pocket watch out and say, "If there is a God, I give him 60 seconds to strike me dead." One of his critics said, "If God can stand Robert G. Ingersoll for 63 years, he can stand him for another 60 seconds." But when he would give his speeches, he would say, "The thing I want to say about Moses is all about," and then pretend he couldn't find the next word. Where did he get that? Yeah. He got that from Charles Finney, because that's the way ordinary people do. We can't always find the words we're looking for. And all of these people introduced into American rhetoric, including the pulpit, the notion of the everyday, sincere, conversational kind of preacher. Next to come along in the nervous breakdowns of American preaching is the emergence of the electronic media, radio and television. And preachers soon realized not only that these were great instruments for proclaiming the gospel, but you had to change the way you preached if you were going to be media savvy. Anybody recognize her? That's Amy Semple McPherson, a weird Pentecostal who in all kinds of ways exploited the media age. One of the things she would do at her Angelus Temple in Los Angeles is arrive for the preaching moment on a motorcycle. Most of us just get up out of the pulpit chair and walk. No. She arrives on a motorcycle, jumps off of it, and says, "You're all going to hell." No, not you. I doubt that you would ride in that outfit. But you can see everything is about the visuals here and the dramatic. She famously was kidnapped at one point, or claimed to be, although at the same time she disappeared, a male member of her staff also disappeared. They were found in Mexico. We're not exactly sure what went on, but all sorts of rumors swirled. The rumors were actually beneficial to her career, just increasing interest. And the impact of radio and television has affected all of us. I preached one time in a church where the service was broadcast on the radio, and it was, come on. Keep it going. No dead air. Let's keep it moving. Sermon is 17.5 minutes, no longer, no shorter. We got to get this thing. It shapes the way you do. And you also begin to think, I'm speaking now to radio land. Or, I'd like to greet the television audience today. And you start losing contact with the people who are actually there and transporting yourself into the larger arena. But it has affected American preaching. Who's he? Yeah. Billy Graham. And Billy Graham sort of fell into some success. He was holding an evangelistic crusade out in Los Angeles, out in California, and William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper publisher, enjoyed hearing him one time and said to his paper, "Puff Graham." And they began to publicize him, and the crowds grew. And then Graham became a ritualistic phenomena in American preaching and evangelism. Every one of his sermons was shaped according to a formula. It starts off, "This is the most terrible time in the history of the world." In the 50s, it was communism. In the 60s and 70s, it was drugs and crime. But something is going on in the world that makes this the worst moment in the history of humankind. Second, the reason for this is sin. Third, you are a sinner. I am a sinner. We are all sinners. Fourth, the only way that this can be remedied is through Jesus Christ and the saving power. Come to Christ. That was the formula for every one of his sermons. He preached at Madison Square Garden in 1957. We have those sermons. He preached in New York City in 1991, one of his last crusades. We have those sermons. They're the same sermons. The stories have been changed a little bit to match the times, but they're basically almost word for word the very same sermons. Dan McAdams at Northwestern University decided, he's a scholar of narrative and rhetoric, he decided, I wonder if there is an American story that we tell about ourselves. So he started watching Oprah Winfrey and reading People magazine, and he found that there is this master narrative that successful Americans tell. It goes like this. I was born an extraordinary person. But I've had some setbacks in my life. But through hard work and perseverance, I've overcome them. And now the future is wide open for me. Now, if you do a kind of a structural analysis, that's a secular version of a Billy Graham sermon. It's the master American story. He probably preached to as more people than George Whitefield, helped by the television media. And interestingly enough, as a Southerner, he made a difference in racial integration in this country by refusing to segregate his crusade, sometimes at great cost. He also compromised the gospel by toadying up to presidents and powerful people and compromising what the gospel could say prophetically. So he's a complicated, genuinely American figure. Anybody been to a Billy Graham crusade in here? Yeah, me too. I have too. I was a pastor in Atlanta when he came to Atlanta, and I've never seen anything more organized. I mean, really kind of organized the churches all over town. All right, what we've seen so far tends to fall theologically on the evangelical, revivalistic side of things. However, one of the nervous breakdowns in American preaching is suddenly American Christians are beginning to become more educated, and the more educated they become, the more questions they have about the way preachers just preach as if they have absolute truth. So the time was ripe for a preacher who preached the questions as strongly as he did the answers. See if you recognize this person. That's Harry Emerson Fosdick, a Baptist who ended up as the pastor of the Riverside Church in New York. He, for many years as a Baptist, was the pastor at First Presbyterian Church in New York. And one of his fans was John D. Rockefeller. And when the Presbyterians got tired of the liberal theology that they thought was blasphemous coming from Harry Emerson Fosdick, they got him out of that Presbyterian church, and John D. Rockefeller built Riverside Church in New York to house the oratory, the ideology, and the ego of Harry Emerson Fosdick. One person said after hearing Fosdick preach, "That man says what I don't believe better than anybody I have ever heard." What did he believe? First of all, he believed in what we call the modern use of the Bible. In fact, he wrote a book by that title. And the modern use of the Bible, as Fosdick interpreted it, was that you have an evolution of the understanding of God in the Scripture. In the Old Testament, you tend to get a kind of a bloodthirsty, militaristic God, but gradually it evolves to the point that you get the God of Jesus Christ, which is a superior development in terms of our understanding of God. He was not afraid to use what was coming from Europe, and that was critical exegesis of the Scripture, which we now teach as, you know, the milk of every theological student's learning, but it was very controversial in that day. He also thought that one of the mistakes that preachers make was to drill Bible data at congregations who are not interested in that. He wrote an article in the 20s in Harper's Magazine called "What's the Matter with Preaching?" And he said, "The problem is that only the preacher comes to the sanctuary interested in what happened to the Jebusites." So Fosdick's preaching was a pastoral counseling from the pulpit. He would start off with a human problem, like fear or doubt or suffering, and then he would bring the resources of the Christian faith to bear on those issues. You had to get a ticket at one point to get a seat at Riverside Church to hear Harry Emerson Fosdick. And for progressive Christians across the country and preachers across the country, suddenly people became Fosdick-styled preachers and became liberal in their theology, progressive in their understanding of Scripture, and human experience-oriented in terms of their approach to preaching. A marvelous example of a fantastic preacher. Then we had a nervous breakdown in the 70s. The preaching of the 40s and 50s was often pretty didactic. It was teaching style. It was, let me tell you the truths of the Christian faith. And those who have studied the sermons of the 40s and 50s say World War II really did strengthen this because that was the moral war, and we had won it. And we were confident in our views of life, and so the confidence comes out in these preachers. The time was ripe for a different style. If the preachers of the 40s were the pulpit princes, this is the anti-prince. anybody recognize him? That's Fred B. Craddock from Humboldt, Tennessee. Great preachers are tall. I was with him at a program one time at Furman University Pastor School, and he said, he got up to speak, and he said, I love being at summer conferences with ministers. Everybody's wearing golf shirts and Bermuda shorts and so relaxed. He said, you may be wondering why I'm not wearing Bermuda shorts. These are Bermuda shorts. He had to carry a box with him so he could see over the pulpit. His voice was not the deep voice of the pulpit prince, but was a little sort of a squeaky voice. And instead of the fine, flowery, fancy sermon, he was the homespun storyteller. Here.
I said, God, don't you have too many children? That's what's being said around in our area a lot. Well, she just has too many children to be a single parent. And I know God is a single parent. So I just said, don't you have too many? And God said, no. That's the end of it. So I asked Molly Shepherd, a friend of mine, she's now deceased, Arapaho Indian, adopted 57 children, died at the age of 88, and she didn't just adopt little pretty little babies. She adopted all the way up, you know, sullen, smack mouth, I'm not wanting to talk to you, adolescents. Tough to deal with, you know, you'd rather be somewhere else with somebody else. She adopted them too. I said, how did you do that? How did you handle it? And she said, we had one rule. The older ones help the younger ones. Those that are able help the ones who are not able. And it worked out fine. I just thought that ought to catch on. It'd be nice if that would catch on. We're going to have to quit saying, well, they're not my kids. Well, they're not my kids. Well, you can't say that anymore. We're all children of God, the family of God. We have been reminded now. Let those who are able take care of those who are not able. That's the primary function, I think, of government, really, as well as church. Not too long ago, I was flying back to Atlanta from, where was I? It's the Ontario, California Airport.
Finney, where was I?
From Los Angeles. But I had been in Loma Linda. You don't have to get all excited. You never heard of it. I hadn't heard of it, but it's a hospital and a huge church and a community, Seventh-day Adventists. And I'd been invited to spend several days out there and had a great time. And I was on the way home. I was seated next to a woman who was going to Atlanta, and I said, you're going home? She said, no, I used to live there. I'm going back to see my grandkids. You at home in Atlanta? Well, I said, close. She said, what were you doing in California? And I said, I was at Loma Linda. She said, oh, that's that Seventh-day Adventist place, isn't it? And I said, yes, it is. Are you Seventh-day Adventist? I said, no, but they invited me. You went to the Seventh-day Adventist place and you're not Seventh-day Adventist? I said, no. I mean, what's the matter here? And she said, I know what you were doing. And I said, boy. She said, you were othering. I said, I was? And she said, yeah, you were othering. I said, what's othering? She said, my preacher preaches on it every Sunday. We need to do more othering. What he means is get acquainted with people who are different from yourself, establish friendship, share in work and play and prayer and praise and everything together. Other people, the other, get acquainted and deal with and relate to the other. He calls it othering. He preaches on it every Sunday. I am so sick of his talking about othering. She got all bothered about it. It's just a fad. It'll pass. I'll be glad when it passes. If he says one more word about othering, I'm going to throw up right there in church. I am so mad. I said, it's not a fad. It's not a fad. She says, it is a fad. She said, look here. And she opened up the Sky magazine, the airline magazine. And there was an article there that was in English, in Spanish, and in Japanese. She said, now look at there. The airline thinks they're othering. She said, a few years ago, it would just be in English. And we'll get back to just having it in English, but it's just a fad. I said, it's not a fad. It's as old as Christianity. And she said, what do you mean? I said, when Jesus died, Allah put a sign on the cross, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, and it was written in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. She didn't say another word. I hated to pull my Bible card, but she was beginning to get on my nerves.
If Augustine said the purpose of a sermon is to teach, to delight, and to persuade, Craddock was influential in ushering in the delight phase of preaching. The beautiful anecdote that doesn't just illustrate a point, but actually does work in the sermon, the use of humor, taking everything that would have been called a weakness in the 40s, his height, his voice, his style, turning it into a strength. Deeply influenced. I've been influenced by Craddock. Many other preachers have. There's a preacher in Atlanta who's 6'5", and he tries to imitate Fred's voice, and it's kind of funny. this tension between the plain speech and the fancy speech can be felt in African-American preaching as well, and I'm going to speed this up because we're... Anybody recognize him? That's Gardner Taylor, who preached at Concord Baptist Church in Brooklyn, New York, and is called the Dean of African American Preachers. And he's a fancy preacher. He still has some of the cadences of the folk preacher in African American preaching. I'm going to play just a short clip of him preaching. You'll see he's got the poetic ability. Can you hear on that one day where there was night twice? I mean, I would love to have that. But it's the fancy style. It's the literary style, even with the call and response going underneath. By contrast, this is James Forbes, raised a Pentecostal preacher, became the pastor at Riverside Church in New York, who preserves more of the folk preacher in the African-American tradition. We'll pray a minute or so of this. Now you can see that's a contrast to Gardner Taylor, but still powerful. The use of the body, everything is there. It was inevitable that television and the formula, I was born an extraordinary person, I've had some setbacks, but I've overcome it now, would come together in an American preacher. Pause that. He's got predecessors. Remember Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of Positive Thinking? There is this strand in American preaching that says, if you can think it, you can have it. If you can think positive thoughts, positive things will happen to you. It's a great message. The only problem with it is it's not true. This is American apple pie. Right here, being foisted from the pulpit. If you like Osteen, I apologize, but there's a kind of corruption and success mentality that is being...
He never went to seminary, never had a preaching professor.
You never had an autism problem. You never went to Princeton. But he attracts huge crowds because this is, I was born an extraordinary person, but I've had some setbacks. But through hard work, that fire's never going to touch me. I've put all that behind me now. Robert Schuller, same at the Crystal Cathedral. This is a major kind of motif in American preaching. I have a clip from her, but I'm just going to let you look at her picture. Do you know who she is? That's Barbara Brown Taylor. Barbara was an administrative aide at an office at Candler School of Theology and trying to become a short story writer and getting one rejection notice after another. Somebody invited her to preach at an Episcopal church in Atlanta, and she agreed to do it and wrote a sermon. And after the service, a woman at the door said, "Could I possibly have a copy of that sermon?" And Barbara said, "My first sale." What she does, she is a fancy preacher in the sense that she has a high literary style. And she's perfectly tuned to the questions and concerns of suburban Protestants, people who are wrestling with the Christian faith. She sort of preaches out on the edges, out on the margins of things. Now, Fred Craddock, who we looked at a little earlier, wrote a book in which he said, quoting Soren Kierkegaard, "There is no lack of information in a Christian land. What's lacking is something else. And you can't communicate that directly. You can only communicate that indirectly." Now, Kierkegaard was talking about Denmark in the early 1800s, but Craddock heard that as a perfect description of America in the 70s. There's no lack of information in a Christian land. We've been Sunday schooled to death. We all know the stuff. What's lacking is something else. We aren't engaged by it. It doesn't delight us. And you can't get delight, 1, 2, 3, directly. You have to talk about, I was on this plane with this woman and she was talking to me about othering. And you have to get at that with story and image and metaphor. Well, that was in the 70s when he wrote that. Well, guess what? It's 2019 and there is a lack of information. And it isn't a Christian land. And so the style of preaching is beginning to shift once again. I can't believe it. This is what's happening.
Or not. And by the way, that decision is not made on the basis of It's never stupid to follow him. It's never stupid to obey him. It's always wise, no matter what the call.
That's Tim Keller. He was the pastor, just retired, pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York. And if you could see the congregation, it would be 2,000 young people. The kind of people that I can't attract with my preaching, who aren't there when I preach, but we want them to come home. The nuns, none of the above is their religious choice. They're packing in to Redeemer Church to hear 45 minutes of a teaching sermon. And what that means, I think, is one of the things that it means is that while some of us have been focusing on delight, telling the stories and using the artful images and so on, we've left a generation unformed. There is a lack of information, and it isn't a Christian land. And for the first time in 200 years, the average American sermon is getting longer rather than shorter, because he's preaching 45 minutes, not because Tom Long's preaching longer, but because he's skewing the average. And thousands of preachers like him who are doing teaching messages. It's a sign of a shift away from narrative preaching, which we've been doing for about 60 or 75 years now, toward what I call wisdom preaching. That is to say, let me talk to you as an older brother about what is true and then how you shall live. These SUV driving 20-somethings out there, they have the good life, but they don't know what a good life is. And so helping people form, and I'm bored by this. But I am chastened by it as well, because it's showing something that's been lacking in my own preaching. Well, I've used up most of the time. I wanted to save a couple of minutes if you've got any rebuttals or questions or anything you'd like to ask about what we've seen today.
The influence of amplification.
Both in good ways and bad ways. By the way, when Riverside Church was built in New York, it did not have a PA system. And Harry Emerson Fosdick mastered the art of standing in that pulpit and looking at a column in the back of the church and throwing his voice to that column so that he could be heard in that big room. In the good ways, it made the pulpit available to more preachers. Fred Craddock would never have been in a non-amplification age. On the other hand, it has dampened what we might call presence in the pulpit, because I can now depend on the microphone to throw my voice, so I don't have to. Notice if I've got to get my voice to the back, my body comes alive. I'm more involved in terms of the whole person in presenting the message. And insofar as that's desirable, then amplification has tended to repress that some. Yeah?
And I'm kind of wondering how Jesus did it with his thousands, you know. How did he really preach to such a large group?
Yeah. We don't know whether the depictions of Jesus preaching in the New Testament are there's some literary license in the New Testament about how things happened, but also Cecil B. DeMille has put an image there that, you know, Jesus probably gave the Sermon on the Mount to a smaller group than you get the multitudes that are there. But it'd be interesting to hear him. I have a feeling he had a pretty strong Galilean fisherman voice. Well, thank you so much for coming this morning.